This is Ocean Robbins, and I'm here to welcome you to day 4 of the Food Revolution Summit, Restoring Our Humanity, a More Ethical World, One Bite at a Time. In a few moments, we'll hear from world-renowned researcher and best-selling author, Dr. Jane Goodall. In an hour, we'll hear from Humane Society of the United States Director Wayne Pacelli. And an hour after that, we'll hear from best-selling author Jonathan Safran Foer. Here we go.
Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our distinguished guest, Dr. Jane Goodall. Dr. Jane Goodall may have had a greater impact on humanity's understanding of animals than any other person who has ever lived. She began her groundbreaking work studying the behavior of primates in 1957. It's brought her global acclaim and generated lasting impact in the fields of habitat preservation, animal welfare, and scientific understanding. Jane is author of more than 20 books and has starred in 19 films and globally broadcast television programs. I grew up watching her work on TV with my mouth dropping in awe when I saw how she had crossed the species barrier and developed profound connection and understanding with other species. Jane has received dozens of awards and has been named a Messenger of Peace by the United Nations. She is the founder of the Jane Goodall Institute and of the Roots and Shoots program. So now, Jane, my dad and I are absolutely thrilled to be able to share your brilliance with this summit. And for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ocean and Jane. Welcome to our audience and to the Food Revolution Network Summit. We are delighted to have you. I want to start by mentioning that I know that you and your co-authors dedicated your earlier book, Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating, to, among others, the millions of farm animals who are held in torment around the world. That is an issue that is profoundly important to me, too. And I want to ask what has led you to your deep concern for the treatment of animals who are raised for meat, dairy products, and eggs in today's factory farms?
Well, I think there are various reasons, but first of all, when I first went to Cambridge University to get my PhD degree, never having been to college before, but having spent a year and a half with the chimpanzees, I was shocked to be told that I had done my study completely wrong, that I shouldn't have given the chimpanzees names, they should have had numbers because that was more scientific, and that I couldn't talk about them having personalities, minds, or emotions. And I had discovered that this wasn't true as a child, particularly from my very special teacher, and that was my dog, Rusty. So the point is that because chimpanzees are so like us, it has enabled me to change attitudes and help people understand that there isn't a sharp line dividing us from the rest of the animal kingdom. And because the chimpanzees are so like us, it's easy for people to grasp. But once you realize that we're not the only beings with personalities, minds, and feelings, you start thinking about the other amazing animals with whom we share the planet. And we do share the planet with billions of cows and pigs and chickens and other animals that are raised for food. Well, my teacher was a dog. The first animal I ever habituated was a pig in a field. I have always had a sort of real interest in pigs. They're highly intelligent in nature. They have close bonds. They're very social. And yet we treat them in such a way that it makes you absolutely sick to see a sow in a farrowing pen where she's kept forcibly lying on her side while she suckles these piglets that she's forced to produce one litter after the next after the next. I also spent a lot of time as a child with cows out in the fields. And when I see the way cows are treated today, the horrendous cruelty, it shocks me. We rescue chickens from battery farms, and they develop their own different ways, and they clearly have their own personalities, and yet there are millions of them stuffed into tiny cages, scarcely able to move, beaks cut off because they would peck each other. The cruelty is so overwhelming and so shocking. So, of course, I have to speak out for them. But over and above that, all this fact that more and more people are eating more and more animals, more and more meat, means huge areas of forest are being destroyed to grow grain, to feed all these animals, or even grazing for the cattle and goats. And the waste of water, because it takes much more water to change vegetable protein into animal protein than it does to feed people from vegetables. And then there's the antibiotics that are needed just to keep these poor animals alive, not because they're necessarily sick, but to prevent them being sick, that are fed to them routinely. And those are getting out into the environment, and the bacteria are building up resistance. And already people have died from a cut on the finger. And then the final thing is that all these billions of animals around the world are producing more and more methane gas, you know, the result of digestion. And that is a more virulent substance as part of the greenhouse gases, even than CO2. So put all this together, and the whole situation is shocking.
It is shocking and disastrous, really. And I feel that the treatment that's routinely perpetrated on farm animals in factory farms and feedlots is really a violation of the human-animal bond instead of an appreciation of it. Although farm animals have been bred as domestic slaves, they're far more aware and intelligent than we generally think, and they are individual beings in their own right. And as such, they deserve our respect and our help. How would you suggest we express that respect and provide that help?
Well, for one thing, it isn't necessary to eat all the meat that we eat, and there are millions and millions of people on this planet who've never eaten meat. When I stopped eating meat back in the late 60s, I think it was, I immediately felt more healthy. I don't think I could be doing what I'm doing now, aged 80, traveling 300 days a year around the world and lecturing and so forth, if I was a meat eater. You know, because for one thing, we have a gut that is actually a herbivorous gut, where you have a long stretch of the intestines so that you can get the maximum benefit from a vegetable diet. But the carnivores have that area very short because they want to get rid of the meat before it starts to rot inside. And we have that kind of gut, and we're filling ourselves up with meat. So I think to get people to understand and to eat less meat or no meat, we have to approach this from different angles. Many people, once they know the torture the animals go through, feel as I felt. Look at a piece of meat on your plate. It symbolizes fear, pain, and death. I don't want to eat that. I don't want that to be part of me. So, you know, some people will respond to that. Some people to the environmental impact, and some people to the impact on their own health. And I think we need to follow each one of those ways. I think that any person who spent any amount of time with a pig or a cow or even a chicken will immediately understand that, of course, they have personalities. And it's like saying that when, in the Holocaust, when human beings were put in those horrendous situations in the concentration camps, would we say, well, because they're all penned up close together in horrible situations, that they have no individuality, no personality? Of course we wouldn't. Of course we would and did want to help them. And I think more and more people are becoming concerned and wanting to help animals. And we have to start with children too and help them to understand.
Today we have many advocates of what are called paleo diets, saying that our distant ancestors were hunter-gatherers who ate a great deal of meat, and so, therefore, should we. Yet, you've written that although the earliest humans probably ate some meat, it is unlikely to have played a major role in their diet. We know that plants were a much more important source of food for almost all of the hunter-gatherer peoples whose way of life lasted into the last century. Jane, you've worked with chimpanzees tremendously. You're world famous for that, and rightly so. When you assimilate all these bits of information about the human diet, human history, our relationship to the natural world, how much meat do you eat, and can you tell us why?
How much meat do I eat? I eat no meat. Chimpanzees do hunt not so often overall. Meat is said to make up about 2% of their diet in a year, which isn't very much. And the big problem in the world today is that as people get more money, they want to eat more and more meat, and they just feel it's normal to have meat for breakfast, meat for lunch, meat for dinner. Actually, it's really bad for your health. It's contributing to the epidemic of obesity. It leads to many digestive problems. And we don't need to eat a lot of meat. We don't need to eat any meat. I mean, every doctor I've seen has said, I don't understand how you're so healthy. How is your immune system so strong? I'm absolutely sure if I was eating meat, I would not be the healthy individual I am today.
I know you're a board member of a group that I support, which is not well known. It's the Non-Human Rights Project, which is the only organization that I know of that is actively working toward legal rights for members of species other than our own. Some critics of the animal rights movement will derisively ask if animal advocates are proposing that animals be given the right to vote, which makes animal rights sound quite foolish. But the Non-Human Rights Project is seeking to change the common law status of at least some non-human animals from mere things or objects which lack the capacity to possess any legal right whatsoever to beings who possess rights to life and to liberty. 50 years ago, it was believed that only humans used and made tools, but thanks to your work and that of others, we now know better. If we could grasp truly that animals are beings, not things, what would change?
I think in some cases it would be easier to fight for the welfare of various animals who are subjected to horrible conditions in entertainment, and some zoos, pet trade and so forth, and all this illegal trafficking that is leading to the extinction of elephants and rhinos for their tusks and their horns. But for me, the really important thing is to change attitudes. I push for human responsibility. Let the animals have rights by all means, but humans have rights, and we abuse them every day, everywhere, all around the world. Human rights are abused. So we need to change attitudes, both to humans, humans other than us, and other animals too. So that's why our Roots and Shoots program, which is for young people from preschool through university, which is in 135 countries, which has about 160,000 active groups, is so very important because we are trying to change attitudes of young people growing up so that they realize that we are not the only sentient, sapient beings on the planet, that animals have their feelings. They know suffering, mental as well as physical. And, you know, we even now know that the octopus is intelligent, that octopus have personalities. So we really have to rethink our attitude to the rest of the animal kingdom.
I have heard you referred to as the voice of the animal world. If the cows and chickens and turkeys and pigs, the animals we use for food, we raise them to eat, if they could talk, what would they say to us? And why would it be so important for us to listen to them?
Well, I think if I was one of those animals, I would be speaking to humanity and saying, can't you understand that I have the same sort of feelings as you? And can't you understand that I have a right to my life, just as you have a right to your life? And don't you think that's where you extend kindness and compassion to other human beings in the same way you could extend that kindness and compassion to us. Animals weren't put on this planet for us to eat. At least, I don't believe so. And I think the sooner we realize that they are not things, they're not objects, they are individuals, the sooner we will start to change our ways. We must, we have to. As human populations grow and we sail up into the billions, there's no way that we could provide enough animal food, quite apart from anything else.
I agree, and I feel very strongly about that, actually. Over the last half billion years, there have been five major mass extinctions when the diversity of life on Earth suddenly and dramatically contracted. We're living today in a phenomenal age. It's the day of the Internet and 1,000 other phenomenal technological achievements. But at the same time, our very way of life is causing the sixth extinction, which by all accounts will be the most devastating since the asteroid hit and the dinosaurs were wiped out 66 million years ago. Given the state of the world we live in today, Jane, why is it important for us to embrace a more natural diet?
Because we live on a planet of finite resources, which we are treating as infinite. We have to think very carefully about our impact on this planet. I think one of the problems is that we've lost the wisdom that the indigenous people had, where you make a decision, what do I eat, what do I wear, and so forth, based on how does this affect the natural resources of the planet? How does it affect the future for our own grandchildren and theirs? We make decisions based on immediate gratification without thinking of future generations. We seem to have got a disconnect between our incredibly clever intellect and the human heart. We are the most intellectual species that ever walked on the planet. We've sent a rocket to Mars, for heaven's sake, that let out a little robot that is crawling around sending down photographs. And that's amazing. And yet we're destroying our only home. And I think it's this disconnect between the clever brain and the human heart, the seat of love and compassion. And I think until we learn to live in a responsible way with the head and the heart in harmony with each other, that we'll never achieve our true potential as human beings.
Well, so beautifully said and so important for us to hear. Your new book, Seeds of Hope, is about that. And I'm thinking about the seeds that we grow today, and many of them are genetically engineered. We've got quite a fight on our hands in the country, in the U.S. today, about the labeling of what are commonly called GMOs. About 90% of our corn and soy and cotton and canola and much of our sugar beets now that are grown in the United States are genetically engineered. And this has brought about an enormous increase in the use of herbicides. Jane, what's your perspective on genetically engineered food and about the issue of labeling?
I find it very scary. I've got a whole chapter on the subject in this new book, Seeds of Hope. I know other people who are publishing facts that really are so shocking and chilling to read. And I've gone quite deeply into the environmental impact. As you say, the resistance that's being built up to herbicides and pesticides has produced super weeds and super bugs that are marching their way across the United States. And the effect of these genetically modified foods being fed to animals, although there are no truly damning reports, every single animal tested showed some adverse effects, usually in the inflammation of various parts of the gut, especially the stomach, and on the kidneys and liver, and on reproductive success as well. So when you think of the environmental impact, when you think of the possible effects on human health in the long term, all these tests are done short term, and the one that was done for 2 years on rats showed absolutely horrific results. So it's very difficult to make absolutely conclusive statements about this, but if you look at all the evidence, it's very suggestive.
I agree, and that's why I advocate for labeling at the very least.
Oh, yes, labeling, of course. It was a big shock, I think, when California, the bill that would force labeling, didn't go through. But I think other states are picking up on it. And we just have to hope that more and more people will stand firm and demand labeling and that these bills will be passed.
We share that hope with you, and we're working very hard, actually, to mobilize people into action in that direction. One of the reasons is something else about these seeds, and that is who owns them. 50 years ago, seeds were overwhelmingly in the hands of farmers and public sector breeders. But recently, the biotech companies, led by Monsanto, have used intellectual property laws to assert dominance over the world's seed supply. Monsanto by itself now directly accounts for a quarter of the world's seed sales, and Monsanto, along with the next two biggest seed companies, DuPont and Syngenta, together sell half of the world's seeds, and they hope to control the rest of it as soon as they can. What's clear is that Monsanto and these other agrochemical companies are intent, it is their business model, to obtain control over the world's food supply. What I want to ask you, Jane, is what will happen if we allow the corporate takeover to completely control our food, and what can be done to stop this corporate takeover?
Well, the only way to stop the corporate takeover is for people to stand up and refuse to buy the product. But unless it's labeled, it's very hard to refuse. And so much food in the United States anyway contains genetically modified food. It's very, very hard. Europe's done pretty well so far. We have stood up against the importation of these seeds, but animal grain is still imported that's genetically modified, so it's by no means complete success. And of course, these companies are trying to sell their products to the developing world. People in the developing world aren't necessarily educated to understand what this all is. And you hear so many times that it's the only way to feed the world. And people who are hungry think, well, then, yes, let's go in for this food if it's going to help us. You know, I've seen the conditions in Africa and parts of Asia, this crippling poverty, this destruction of the environment and desperate efforts to grow a little bit more food to feed the family. So how do we combat the takeover by these companies? Only through education, I think. Through education, which will lead to public understanding of the issue, which should lead to the public in countries where they can standing up against the takeover of their right to their own seeds and foods. You know, I'm not an expert in agribusiness. I'm not an expert in ecological farming. But I've talked to enough people who are, and it seems from everything I've read that the way to feed the world is small-scale family farming, and that the genetically modified foods are not actually providing more food than the foods grown in the traditional way.
It's true. There's some major studies that show a failure to yield. There isn't any greater productivity from these seeds, but they do require more synthetic petroleum-based fertilizers. They do require, of course, way more herbicides. They are not giving us the things that had been promised, and they are giving us the things we don't need or want. This is another example, to me, of something that I see in our world. What I want to ask you about is, I know you have three grandchildren.
Yep.
What do you feel, and what kinds of commitments arise in your heart when you reflect on what we humans have done to life on Earth since you were their age?
It's this feeling of desperation and anger and shame of our species that really keeps me going. Because when I think of how we've harmed this planet since I was a small child, and I think about it almost every day, it is so shocking. There are so many people who firmly believe that we are on such a downward spiral with the destruction of ecosystems and so forth that it's too late for change and that we're doomed as a species. I don't have any grounds to stand on to say I believe that we still have a window of time. I'm not alone in this. But if we can't change attitudes fast enough, and if we can't create a society of people who understand that we need money to live, but we mustn't live for money, and a society that understands that the behavior of each one of us impacts the planet every single day, and if we will just think about the consequences of what we eat and what we wear and where it came from and how it was grown and did it involve animal suffering or child slave labor, you know, once we get that sort of society, maybe we can start changing things. Climate change, terrifying. Look what's just been happening. The coldest winter that the East Coast of the U.S. has recorded, certainly the wettest winter that we've known in the U.K. I've just driven past fields which are now lakes with swans on them. The worst typhoon in living memory to hit land was hitting the poor old Philippines. The droughts, the bushfires in Australia and parts of sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, all this is really terrifying. And it's so scary that people look at this whole picture and they feel utterly hopeless, and so they do nothing. That's what we have to overcome. If people don't have hope and we do nothing, particularly our children, then there is no hope. This is what keeps me going 300 days a year all around the world, trying to spread this message that we have a lot that we can do ourselves, each single one of us. And individually, of course, it doesn't make any difference. But collectively, the more people we get understanding that, yes, I make a difference. I can make choices which actually do impact negatively or positively the future. Then that's what we have to do. And that's what I'm fighting for with the Jane Goodall Institute and the Jane Goodall's Roots and Shoots. We have to.
Well, we're with you, and I thank you for all you're doing to raise the level of hope and love, for that matter, in the world. Now, I want to ask you about something. When I think about the human species and its capacity for violence, and I think of chimps, who have also demonstrated a proclivity for killing their own species on occasion, though not in the systematic and mass-produced way that we have, that we call war. There's another animal, sometimes called a chimp, but it isn't. I'm thinking about the bonobo, though there might be recorded cases. I'm not aware of any of a bonobo killing another bonobo. Some say we may be even closer genetically to them than to chimpanzees. What's your perspective on bonobos, and is there something we might learn about ourselves from them?
I'm not sure. You know, I've never studied bonobo in the wild. I do know in captivity they can be extremely aggressive and males have to be separated. But I don't think there's been a case of actual killing among the bonobo. As far as I'm aware, the genetic structure of chimpanzees, bonobos, and humans is equidistant. In other words, we're related more or less equally genetically, both to chimpanzees and bonobos. But I think what we have to take from this is that we have this highly developed intellect, and we can make choices. We may have inherited aggressive tendencies from chimpanzees and more peaceful ones from bonobos, maybe. And let's start exercising our ability to make choices that counteract our inherited genetic makeup. We can choose. And most people do control their aggressive impulses. They don't go around hitting people. Some people do, but you know what I mean. Most of society doesn't. It's in our language, oh, I could kill him. I could murder her. You know, we say this, but most of us don't actually do that. So we can exercise control. And again, it's a question of early upbringing for our children. I've seen with my own son that he used to have sudden, very violent aggression against something, but he learned to control it. He doesn't do it anymore.
When you mentioned children, I remember that when you were 12, or so I've heard, you founded your own nature club, the Alligator Society, and members were required to identify 10 dogs, 10 trees, 10 birds, and 5 butterflies or moths. I wonder how many 12-year-olds today, or really for that matter, how many adults could do that. And have we lost something precious in distancing ourselves as much as we have from the natural world?
Well, first of all, I think that the fact that so many children today spend time with electronic equipment, they don't get outside, some of them can't. The inner city kids, you know, it's very hard for them. We have to work really hard, and we do with our Roots and Shoots program, to take nature to them and as much as possible get them to actually, you know, feel the earth, watch something grow. It just makes a difference. And it's a tragedy that so many children are deprived of opportunity to interact with nature. Because when you understand it, you start loving it and wanting to protect it. I also, as I'm traveling around, get the feeling that young people, certain outstanding young people who shine and have leadership qualities, that they are in a way rising to meet this really difficult challenge that young people face today, moving out into a world which we have so destroyed. Supporting these young people who have the leadership ability, who have the drive, who have the passion and the commitment. This, to me, is a really, really important goal.
Well, I know, Jane, that you are an inspiration to those young people whose leadership is being evoked by the very pain and destruction that their elders have left them with. You are an inspiration to millions of people, people like me, who are filled with admiration and respect for your huge heart and your great wisdom and your outstanding contributions to our world. I think you're somebody who's probably raised the level of compassion and wisdom in every room you've ever entered. And you've done so not just by being a voice for chimpanzees, though that you have, but also by being a voice for the whole Earth community. I feel the Earth heart speaking through you. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have this conversation with you, and on behalf of everyone involved with the Food Revolution Network, I thank you. I thank you for your lifetime of service to all of our greater good, and I thank you for being the absolutely extraordinary woman and human being that you are.
Well, thank you. I can only say thank you. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm just me, doing what I feel I have to do, and I will continue as long as my body allows me to.
We've been talking with Dr. Jane Goodall, founder of the Jane Goodall Institute and the Roots and Shoots program, and author of Seeds of Hope. Jane, your work for more than 50 years has been helping to restore the heart of humanity. Millions of people all over the world have been falling in love with you for generations, and I think it's easy to see why. It's been such a joy to share this time with you today. Thank you for being part of the Food Revolution.
Thank you very much.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get CDs, members-only courses, and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. And now we have a pre-recorded message from Dr. Don Adegon of Seattle, Washington, on how the Food Revolution Summit has impacted her life.
Hi, everybody. This is Dawn Irene Adegon, co-founder of PrimalTrust.com. I'm a licensed PhD clinical psychologist, certified yoga, acro yoga teacher, and a mom. I'm here to share with you my food revolution incredible story. Throughout my teenage years, I struggled with depression off and on and significant struggles around my relationship with food. Despite that, mind over matter, I rocked out my PhD. I was an extreme athlete, triathlete, advanced yogi, endurance horseback racer, until I hit my 40s and had my son. After 2 years of sleepless nights, working full-time, going full bore, I hit a complete wall. I went to my primary care provider. She gave me a powerful benzodiazepine, sent me to every specialist under the sun, with no one who could really help me. No relief whatsoever for any of my symptoms. After 5 years of studying, self-study, trying to figure out how to help myself, I ran across the Food Revolution Summit. I downloaded their information, and there was something really unique about what they had to offer. So I listened and studied avidly what those speakers had to say. I bought the empowerment package and started to really apply the principles that were really new. I had thought I knew everything about nutrition, but, you know, this summit really opened my eyes to a new way of self-healing. A year later, I am ecstatic to report I am depression-free for the first time since I can remember. I have transformed my relationship with food in ways that I never imagined possible. My most recent medical exam, my labs were within normal limits or better. I have more vitality, spark for life, joy, happiness, a new relationship that supports me in every way, nourishes me in every way. I encourage you to pay attention. Open your heart and mind. The food revolution has answers for every single person who's ready. Thank you all so much. Take care. Be well.
If you want to express your opinions on what you've been hearing and find out what other people are saying, post and engage in the comments section at the bottom of our broadcast page. Remember to refresh the page to see the latest. You can also join us and join in the conversation on our main Facebook page at facebook.com/foodrevolutionsummit. Our next presentation will be an interview with Humane Society of the United States Director Wayne Pacelli. It will start at the top of the hour, followed an hour later by Jonathan Safran Foer. Until then, here's some music from our friend, Bruce Beckvar.